Welcome to The Hobcast, a weekly podcast from Hoback Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of building a new creative business in this pandemic world. We'll hear from the people who make all this possible, the authors, cover designers, and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on The Hobcast from Hoback Books, as we combined trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello. Hello and welcome to a special edition of The Hobcast. Technically, show number 64.
64, yes.
But we are at the London Book Fair. You can probably hear behind us.
The hubbub.
The hubbub, yes. We're overlooking the main hall, the grand hall, in fact, of Olympia, where all the big publishers have their amazing looking stands.
Oh, they're very impressive, aren't they?
Yeah,
these
it's
big
pretty
boxes.
Flash. And then away to, as we look down into the atrium of the grand hall, we're up on the first floor. We look down, there are rows and rows of desks, and it looks like it could be an exam hall, but what it
I'm
actually
thinking
is,
speed dating.
Yes, could be speed dating, yes. Well, it feels like that's what we've got to do while we're here in many ways, because we're sort of knocking on those or approaching those desks and asking for people to have a chat with us. But there, that's where all the agents are, and that's where all of the rights experts are. So you've got the publishers, the big trade publishers in front of us now,
yeah.
and national stands as well. Up on the top deck where we are, it's slightly smaller operations, but also it's where we've been spending quite a lot of our day in amongst the indie publishers and the indie author community, where we feel at home. And we've seen some of the people that you've heard on this podcast before. We've had a chance to meet them in the flesh. Simon McLeave, we had a quick chat to just before he was, I think he was winning an award.
He was up for an award, wasn't
he? He was up for the selfies. We've just had a lovely conversation with Rachel McLean, who was on the show, what, 6-7 weeks ago? Something like that.
Yes, reminiscing on the random question.
Absolutely. And we have spoken to one of the most successful British indie authors in the crime scene currently, J.D. Kirk, or Barry Hutchison, as he is known by his family. So Barry joins us and tells us, again, a really fantastically open and illuminating interview about how he's got to the position he is now, where he's regularly number one in the Amazon charts. And he was on the Amazon stand, but we had about 40 minutes to talk to him. So that'll be our big feature interview in a few moments' time. We've got other things lined up for you for future specials. We're going to be doing two more shows here from the London Book Fair.
Yeah, one each day.
One each day. So we've got quite a number of guests lined up. Some of them surprising. And we're going to be joined tomorrow by our very own Robert Dawes.
Uncle Bob is coming with
us. He is. We're going to wheel him around like a big celebrity.
Exhibit A?
Yeah, I don't know. I bet he's recognised by, well, for instance, we've got the, there's the Arab Publishers League stand there. I bet he's huge there. I bet the Royal still plays very big in Arab countries or something like that.
Wouldn't it
like
be
that.
Funny, though, if we happen to walk past one of the country stands and he gets mobbed because
yeah,
the Royal is
he's
currently
huge in Estonia. That would be very, very good. Look, our impressions of London Book Fair, it's exactly, we've visited very casually once when it was last held here. And it's not dissimilar.
No.
The stands look very, very similar.
It's very similar.
Thousands and thousands of people here. It's a bit quieter now. It's nearly 6 o'clock in the evening and the show is about to shut for the day. But the fact is that it is an overwhelming experience when you first come here.
Yeah.
And it's not just the bustle, is it? It's the sense of everyone else seems to know what they're walking with such purpose. The sort of thing you don't see, frankly, where we live in Staffordshire.
No, well, I've made three key observations of the London Book Fair. The first is, there are lots of tables and chairs, yet there's nowhere to sit.
True.
Because all the stands and
you pay for the privilege.
Yeah, you pay for the privilege. So the place is full of tables and chairs, but we couldn't find anywhere to sit, so we actually sat by the balcony on the floor having a coffee this morning.
That's true. That's true, yeah. I've sat cross-legged for the first time since leaving junior school today. It wasn't comfortable. I'm not the most flexible human, and it took you about half an hour to get me up again. But, the coffee, I mean, you said, oh, go and find somewhere to sit. I'll queue for the coffee. You bet you regret that decision.
I do. I was in the queue for 40 minutes. They got the order wrong, and they got stroppy with me when I said, I only want one decaf.
Yeah.
That wasn't pleasant.
I think the other thing that strikes you when you first come here is the diversity of what is published. The incredible range of things that people are prepared to pay money for to read.
Well, that leads me to my second key observation of the London Book Fair. The yes. place is full of books, yet you can't buy them.
That is true. That is true. Sometimes they'll give you one. We're going to get him on the podcast because he was such a fascinating character.
Pineapple guy.
Well, there's a guy called Steve, and he was not far from the indie section of authors, and he's written a book based around the pineapple being the metaphor for his philosophy of business and life. He's paid a lot of money to have a stand here, I must admit, and he has a pineapple on his desk, and that got us talking to him.
It was my fault. I saw his pineapple.
Well, you will always... Anything quirky will catch your eye. Yeah. That's always the case.
And he was quirky.
He certainly was. So I'll tell you what, we'll speak to him for your benefit sometime in the next couple of days. Because
we'll catch him again.
The world needs more Pineapple Man.
We need more Steve.
How many pigeons are flying around the hall at the moment? That's three.
Oh, yeah.
That's bizarre.
Yeah, they're... Not that anyone can see that, but yes, there are three pigeons.
Three pigeons flying around this gigantic...
I have one final observation about the London Book Fair.
Yes.
It is incredibly colourful.
It is.
There's vibrant. There's pink, there's blue, there's purple, there's...
Well, I mean, if you haven't, you know, even there's themed carpets as well that for the different areas. And particularly as we're standing very close to the children's books
Which
section.
Is bright pink.
Oh, gosh, yes, absolutely. And, they're having a little wine reception for pretty books.
But is it...
Who do preschool stuff by the look of it.
But isn't that strange? So we're just next to a section that is colourful and decorated for children, full of children's books, yet there are no children here.
No.
To appreciate how beautiful it is.
No, that's true. That's true. It's a difficult environment in terms of the number of people here. It gets very hot. It's epically huge place. So you can do your 10,000 steps just walking around the hall. But it is lovely when you bump into someone you know or you make new contacts and friends. And we've done a little bit of that today. So that's been a real pleasure. We're quite introverted. I mean, even though we do a podcast, it sounds ridiculous. We are quite introverted.
People are surprised when they find out how introverted we are. But we went back to the hotel at lunchtime and we stayed there for a couple of hours because we just needed to sort of...
Yeah, decompress a little bit.
A sense of calm. And
yeah, absolutely. My legs were killing me and I just wanted to elevate them. I feel a lot better now, I must admit. But I think once you got your first day, it reminds me of when I used to cover the Olympics. You go to an Olympic Games, and it takes about 3 days to cope with the pace of everything that's going on around you. The energy, the sheer numbers of people. And that's just in the broadcast centres. It's absolute bedlam, and eventually you get into your rhythm. Now, the trouble is this is only a three-day event, so you've got to get into your rhythm pretty quickly.
And then go home.
But I think I think tomorrow will be a day where we feel a lot more comfortable in the environment. There's
Hopefully,
always
yeah.
that first morning thing where it was so busy this morning when we first arrived. It was bedlam, and it was one of those things where you couldn't, if you were stood still for more than a second, you got mown over by somebody heading somewhere with a sense of a business stride to them. So... Yeah, it's an interesting place. But we've brought you a special interview with J.D. Kirk, or Barry Hutchison. He started his J.D. Kirk pen name a few years ago and has been one of the poster boys, really, for British indie authors in terms of what can be achieved. And what was surprising in this interview, he's a very modest guy, lovely, lovely man, from his home in the Highlands, is how he's managed to achieve it without spending the megabucks. by figuring out what people wanted to read and
just making friends with them. And
exactly. Building a lovely audience that follow every move. And it's worked for him. And it was a really enjoyable interview. I have to say. So let's speak to Barry Hutchison.
Well, we'd like to welcome one of the most successful indie authors in the UK today, Barry Hutchison, or J.D. Kirk, as you
yeah,
as you write.
Call me either one, I don't mind.
It's a great honour for us to have you here on the Hopcast Book Show. Thank you for joining us.
No, thanks for having me.
It's you've been on the KDP stand for today, yeah, and fielding all sorts of queries. What sort of things do people come to you to ask?
It varies, really. There's some people come because they've thought about self-publishing but never really started with it, never given it a go. So they're just looking for a bit of, I think a lot of them are looking for a bit of a nudge to kind of to get started. So they'll say, I've been approaching publishers, I haven't heard anything, or I've had a couple of rejections and I'm thinking about self-publishing. Should I do it? You know, and I kind of go, yeah, yeah, absolutely. Because I was traditionally published for 10 years. And KDP kind of not only gave me a sort of financial freedom I didn't have before, but a creative freedom that I didn't have before as well. So I always recommend people that are maybe a bit scunnered with traditional publishing, good Scottish word that.
Yeah.
Terrific, yeah.
To give indie a go. And I think increasingly we're seeing, it used to be seen as the fallback position was, I'll self-publish. And increasingly we're seeing people going, no, I'm not going to bother with the traditional publishing
yeah,
stuff.
So
I'm just going straight into doing it myself. And I think for me, for 10 years I was writing books, but it was never enough to really pay all my bills. So I was constantly trying to come up with a business idea at the same time. So I had like five or six failed business ideas running alongside my books. And it's when I realized that the books were my business,
yeah,
that's when everything fell into place for me. And I went, okay, so my product is these books. And what's the best way of making money from this product? Is it by sending it to a publisher where it will be lost amongst several hundred other books that publisher's publishing that year? Or is the best thing for that book if I manage how it goes out into the world and how it's marketed? And once I realised that, everything changed for me, really.
Is that, in a sense, you know, having had those failed business ideas, mm-hmm, did that make it easier to take that leap? Or did that scare you because you'd had that failing, if you like?
Not really, no. I think it just made sense all of a sudden, because I was a full-time author, technically. I was a full-time children's author. What that generally means is that you get a little bit of money from writing books and you become a public speaker. You go into schools. We're fortunate in Scotland with the Scottish Book Trust, and they will pay you to go into schools and you can talk to kids for an hour about writing or about your books or about books in general, or do workshops or whatever, and you get paid for doing that. Now, most of my income came from doing that. And the reason I got to do that was because I wrote books. So very little of my actual income came directly from books.
That's very interesting, isn't it? I think people have this idea, don't they? That
yeah, people think, oh, you're a public, a children's author, you're J.K. Rowling. and there's only one of her. Most children's authors that I know make the money through speaking events. So you become a kind of paid public speaker,
yeah,
who's written some books. So I was a full-time author, so I didn't have to worry about giving up a job. I just thought, well, okay, I'm not making a huge amount. I know the books are doing well, they've been well received. Publishers want me to publish more of them. So I know the product itself is decent, and I've learned a bit from my multiple failed businesses about how to just structure a business and how to go about taking that product and bringing it to market. And it never worked before because I never had a decent product. But then I thought, well, this is my product, and now all I have to do is apply what I've learned in those other businesses to bring it to market. And that's what I started doing. And I did that through KDP Publishing.
But right. how difficult was that, though? Because surely, presumably, your other businesses weren't books.
No, my other businesses were a range of things that were all disasters. So it was just about learning it. It was about going, okay, so I know the principles of I need to make people aware of this product and set this product at a price that is affordable to that customer. So I knew those sort of basics of it. The details I had to learn from scratch. So I had no idea how I would market that book to those readers. No, I was working with writing for children prior to that, and the way you market to children is you go to their school and you tell them, I've got this book out. Now, I couldn't go around people's houses and go, do you want to read this comedy sci-fi book, which is what I published at the time. So I had to find where that audience existed, you know, and it was like, well, what I'm writing for is sci-fi geeks. So you would join, you know, sci-fi groups on Facebook, and you would get to know people through there. And I hate the idea of, I'm really rubbish at marketing myself. I'm terrible at going on and going, read my book is great.
It's a very British thing.
Yeah, it is. And I kind of go, you know, oh, and by the way, you know, I try and be helpful. I try to go on and go and make myself useful. I interact and I kind of, you know, build relationships in the group, and then go, oh, and by the way, you're probably not interested, but just in case, I've written these 12 books.
That, you know, is, so that is such a British.
Yeah.
Like, you're probably not interested. But
well, as I actually paid, I kind of mentioned it in the talk I was doing earlier on there. I got an advert done for the Space Team sci-fi books. And I got a guy to go on, and he did this. It was really American, this really kind of upbeat sales pitch. But it was, if you're looking for a book that's like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, but worse, read Space Team. You know, and so I couldn't even bring myself to go, no, it's good. It was like, yeah, it's a bit like that, but not as good as that. So that, so set your expectations low. So but that seems to work, especially with humour. People go,
yeah, sure.
Oh, I see the joke there.
Yeah.
But I was being serious. It wasn't a joke.
They thought you were joking.
Yeah, they thought, like, oh, he's having a laugh at his own expense. And I was like, no, I don't want to say it's good, because you might not think so.
So now you've reached a situation where you are one of the most successful indie authors on the KDP platform. So clearly there's been a mindset switch, I would imagine. Do you still feel that sense of reticence of selling yourself?
No, I still feel... I have to... What I've learned to do, I think, is... So the author part of my brain writes the book, and then I have to switch over to a publisher part of the brain to write the Amazon description page, or to write kind of any marketing that goes with it. Because if I write it as myself, I just feel deeply uncomfortable at saying that I'm good at anything. No, I don't want to say you're going to enjoy this, because I've written it. But if I can switch to publisher mode and say, okay, Barry Hutchison or J.D. Kirk has written this, it's much easier to sell it that way. So it is, it's almost like developing a kind of split personality
absolutely.
You know, the publisher part does all these things.
Yeah.
And the author part just writes these books. And it's learning to do that has been the biggest mind shift for me, I think.
But it's interesting, isn't it? The difference between, we try to explain this to our authors when we've signed them up and we're starting to write their blurbs for them. The difference between the sales pitch blurb and what many of them think should be there, which is a précis of the synopsis, you know, condensed into three paragraphs.
Yeah.
That's not presumably what you do.
No, not at all, no. And I think my first attempts were like a detailed blow-by-blow of everything that happens. And then I thought, well, why would anyone read the book?
You know what
I
mean? They don't need to.
They don't need to. They know what happens. So it became very much finding what is the hook? Who's the main character? What is the situation they've been thrown into, and what's the hook that might make the reader want to read about that character in that situation? And so all my kind of blurbs are now a variation on that. It's that thing. I found something that worked for me. It goes, okay, this person, this happens, this is the complication that you might be interested in. You know, buy the book to read what happens.
I think it's very similar for us, isn't it? We have a formula for our blurbs now.
To an extent, yeah. I mean, I think... You know, I mean, we have a process where we'll get the author's version, then you'll have a go at it.
Then you'll ignore it.
And rewrite it completely.
Yeah. And then I'll go in.
Tidy it up.
Yeah. And what I tend to do is, because I've come from a broadcast BBC journalism background, where everything has to be colloquial to some extent and tightened to the nth degree. And that's what I do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a good process, actually.
It is, yeah.
I think
and
that's really important as well,
author.
yeah. Because a lot of times you look at blurbs and you know you could take three paragraphs out of that.
Yeah.
And it would not only tell the same information, but do so in a much more interesting way. So that less is more thing is really important.
Absolutely, yeah.
What about, though, what we find so uncomfortable, being indie publishers still, and we were debating this today when we found out we couldn't claim VAT on our Facebook ads, but the marketing spend to be able to get to the sort of sales that return a living, it's quite frightening, isn't it?
Well, I've been really fortunate. I think I've set out not to really do paid advertising as much as a lot of other authors do. I kind of set out trying to build a community around my books. And kind of grow them through word of mouth that way. So to start with, I first started spending £5 a day on Facebook ads, and I was furious having to spend that money. because being Scottish, we don't like to part with them. So I didn't do that until I was kind of three books in. And at that point, you know, they were making decent money. And I started that £5 a day, and I was really slow to build up. So now I talk to authors, and they're spending kind of, you know, £30,000-£40,000 a month on marketing. And I think I spend about £3,000 a month on advertising. So I don't quite know. I think a lot of it is just luck and word of mouth. And I think it is going right, you know, it's especially with the crime books. I was very analytical. I thought, right, what is doing well? What does a successful crime fiction novel cover look like? Regional stuff was doing well. I thought, okay, well, I know the Highlands really well, and that means I don't have to do any research as well, which is always a bonus. So I thought, I'll set it around
like
the Highlands.
You know.
Yeah, exactly. That's it, yeah. Set it around the Highlands. The thing that put me off writing crime fiction for a long time was actually that whole idea of research, of going, right, I need to know what the police do. I need to understand what...
Yeah.
And then I spent quite a bit of time researching it for the first book, and absolutely nothing made it in because police procedure was really boring.
Yeah, it's quite dry.
Tedious. So I was like, okay, I can write a book where 200 man hours are spent knocking on doors and there's a team of 100 people involved, or I can go, I'll write an interesting story and occasionally I'll use a police acronym.
Yes. And that's enough.
That's the credibility.
Because readers don't want to know about what an actual police investigation is like because it's tedious. They want a dramatised version of that. They want a good story that makes them think, okay, this seems believable enough that the police might do this sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. I mean, because also you've got the separate system to the one that we're used to being from England.
That's
procurator, fiscal,
and
the different burdens of proof that apply in Scottish.
Yeah, it's a completely different legal system, that's it, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. So I think writing it to market has helped me immensely. It's going, right, what are people buying right now? And then that's what I did to start with, certainly, and that got enough people interested in the books that it built an audience. And then they're now far more interested in the characters. It's like the crime series has become like a soap opera.
Yes.
That has murders in it, rather than a book predominantly about murders. Monique's book obviously has a real crime with real consequences and victims and you know, the investigation and all that stuff happens. But all the feedback from the readers is about, oh, he got a dog in this book. You know, that's really exciting. And so one of the main detectives acquired a dog that was found at the scene of a crime. And it was going to be for that one book. But the amount of people that emailed saying, great, he's got a dog. I can't believe he's got a dog.
Don't you dare kill the dog.
I had to keep the dog. Yeah, well, I killed a cat in book one and I will never hear the end.
No.
I killed a cat and three children. Nobody cares about the children.
No,
the cats.
They all care about the cat.
Absolutely.
So I learned that lesson quickly. So never killing more animals. But the dog was supposed to be a one-off little joke. But people become so invested in the characters. They're like, oh, he needs a dog. Yeah, he needs. That's just what he needs, is a dog to cheer him up. You know. So you're going, well, I've now got to write this dog in, and it worked brilliantly. The dog has been a great addition to it, and people, you know, it works really well. But it's a soap with murders.
Do you think to some extent then the readers are writing the book for you? They're giving you things that they want.
I think you've certainly got to listen to them. Yeah, like I know that if I went and killed off one of the main characters, there would be a mutiny. You know, you would find my head in a spike somewhere. But I wouldn't want to kill them off anyway. There are main characters who have died in the series because I wanted that sense of jeopardy to know.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Any of them can die at any time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not saying I will never kill off any of the characters, but I will have to brace myself for the backlash that will result in that. And I know if anyone who reads it is listening to this now, I will get emails about this interview, about this point in the interview saying, do not kill off any of the characters or we will hurt you. So I think it's about listening to the readers, but ultimately the story you have to write, as the author, you have to write the story that you believe in. If I went, I'm going to write my story dictated by what the readers have suggested, because they've all suggested plots and they've all suggested different things. If I was to write the stories based on that, they would no longer be my books. And that's, they're buying my books. They want my story, not theirs, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So I think it's being aware of what your reader's looking for, but first and foremost, you're writing that book for yourself, based on the story you want to tell.
How influenced are you by the strength of Scottish crime writing as a whole, the tartan noir
I mean, scene?
To be honest, before I started writing crime fiction, I hadn't really read any. And what's interesting is a lot of people says, oh, it's really fresh, it's really different. And I was like, that's because I've got no idea what it's supposed to be like.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Scottish crime fiction is doing brilliantly. You know, I mean, Val McDermid, Dineen Rankin, and Chris Brookmyre. Yeah, I mean, I love Chris Brookmyre.
Oh,
Chris
I Brookmyre, do too.
Chris Brookmyre is the exception. When I said I hadn't read any crime fiction before that, I had read pretty much all Chris Brookmyre stuff. And that that kind of humour that is in all his books, that's I do the same. I tried to be serious. I tried to write when I started the J.D. Kirk pen name. I thought, right, this is going to be really serious, because I'd done comedy before that.
Sure.
I thought this is going to be a really serious, proper police investigation. And I had it all planned out, and then the first line of the book was, the total collapse of Duncan Reed's life began with a gate in the arse end of nowhere. And when I wrote that, I thought,
damn it.
Shit. And it all went downhill from there, really. So.
Oh, we love a good first line. We're obsessed with them, actually.
I am, yeah. I collect first lines.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's a cracker. Absolute
so
cracker.
So that yeah that and that and that I think set the tone of it for me, because I kind of had the plot, but I didn't feel I quite had that the voice for it at that point. And then I wrote that first line, and I immediately thought, I know what this book is. I know where this is going, and it just developed over the course of the series. So now, I mean, most of the comments I get were people saying, I was listening to the audiobook and I was in tears of laughter in Tesco's, and people thought there was something wrong with me and stuff. So it is the characters and the humour is what people keep referencing for me. And I don't think anyone's really said, I love that murder. I love the way you cut that guy's head off. Which would probably be quite worrying if they did, I suppose. But yeah, characters and humour is what brings them back. Come for the murder, stay for the characters. That's brilliant.
In terms of being here at London Book Fair, which is quite... staggeringly
it's
in its scale.
It's huge.
Yeah, it's very pink carpet.
Yeah, absolutely. This is sort of the pink zone for the indies, it seems. Does it bother you that, I mean, we were talking to Simon McLeave just a moment ago, and he was saying that he went up to HarperCollins, where he's just signed for one of their offshoots in Avon, and they didn't know who he was. They treated him almost like, you know, like detritus on the shoe. Do you feel that sort of antipathy from the traditional side of things? I mean, you've worked within environment.
I have worked quite extensively. Not really. I think, almost to me, publishing has kind of flipped. And I think, you know, once upon a time in the not-too-distant past, we looked at self-publishing as a vanity thing. We go, that's vanity publishing. You're doing that because so you can get your name on a book. And I think that's really starting to kind of flip around the other way now. I look at traditional publishing. If I was to do a traditionally published book, it would be pure vanity for me. It would be, oh, I want to go to Bath Festival, or I want to talk about whatever, you know. Because it is difficult for indie authors to get a lot to the bigger festivals.
Yeah.
I've been fortunate that I have a lot of contacts at them from my traditional publishing days, so I've been able to do some of the festivals, you know, as an indie.
Yeah.
But just coming in as an indie without that background is really, really difficult. So I think now people who are indie publishing are making substantially more money in a lot of cases than traditionally published authors.
Yes.
But traditionally published authors are going, well, I still have that clout of being with a traditional publisher.
Mm.
So that vanity element, I think, is now being more associated with traditional publishing than it is with indie publishing, which is where a lot of kind of like really interesting new voices are emerging, and people are writing books that readers love. And the traditional stuff is more about, I want to be, you know, at the Cheltenham Festival, or I want to be in the Guardian. Yeah, I want to be. And more indies are doing that, though. I mean, my books are in the Tables and Waterstones, because I started working with a distributor in Scotland, and they work with Gardeners and doing print ones through CPI, who are just based over there. And it's more work, obviously. But it means my books are reaching different audiences. They're in Morrison's for the first three books, we're in Morrison's, and they're taking the next ones. And so it is possible to do it as an indie as well. That's all opening up more and more. So I think, I think, you know, 5 years from now, we will look at traditional publishing as vanity publishing.
Yeah, I think to an extent. But the other thing they've done during the pandemic is they've recognised what you and other indie authors had recognised was the power of reaching out digitally.
Yeah.
And now, you know, no longer are they thinking of ebook rights as something they can actually, you know, even sign sometimes.
Yeah, that's it. A little add-on,
But in terms of their marketing spend on Amazon ads and Facebook has gone up monumentally in the last year, hasn't it? And they kind of parking their tanks on the lawn for
for the likes of us. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because a lot of them have some very big budgets. But what I always found working with traditional publishers was they had very big budgets for a select few authors.
Yes.
That's right, yeah.
And almost nothing for anyone else. You know, like, I assumed when I signed with traditional publishers that they would do marketing. And generally speaking, they didn't. They would go, okay, you can do that. You can you know, do social media, you can do blog tours, and they might help arrange a blog tour, but you do all the write all the content for it, you make the videos or whatever it may be. And the difference was, though, that if I did that, I had no idea if that was affecting sales or not.
No, so
I
could go, you can't see the data.
You know, in 6 months' time, I'll get a royalty statement that'll tell me the money that I haven't earned, the money that I haven't paid back or the advance. And it'll give me an idea of numbers, but it won't tell me when those numbers come in.
No, so you can't change what you're doing.
Exactly, that's it.
Act.
So now if I go, right, I'm going to do this thing, and I can immediately look on my dashboard in KDP and go, okay, that sold some books, so I'll do that thing again. What if I do it and it doesn't sell some books? I'll say, well, that's a waste of time. I don't have to do that. So it really helps you hone your marketing strategy as well. But yeah, I think they're really starting to learn a lot from indies, I think. I think they're realizing that we are a massively growing part of the publishing landscape.
Yeah.
And they go, well, what can we nick from you guys?
Yeah, and it's kind of, I mean, the way we're looking at it is, where's the angle next for indies? Where is the virgin territory in terms of reaching new readers that the traditional publishers aren't moving into? And there's a lot of talk about TikTok. Is that something that would appeal to you?
Oh, you're on TikTok.
Well, I don't know, everyone kept saying get on TikTok, and I went on TikTok and I did about 3 videos and I thought, nah, it's not for me. It's not for me. I think it's about, you know, it works for some people, and certain genres is going to work really well.
Yeah.
But there are so many things that you could do. You could spend, you know, your day 10 times over doing different types of marketing, but ultimately the best marketing for the next book best marketing for your current book is the next book.
Yeah.
So I'm all, the first and foremost, I'm about writing books, and I will try and fit some stuff around that. But I think what I've discovered works well for me is just being authentic. So on social media, I'm not going, hey, look, here's my book, or I'm not trying to join in any trends or fads or anything. I'm just going, all right, you know, how you doing? This is what's been happening to me. And that works really well in my mailing list. Now, I've got a mailing list of about 20,000 people.
Right.
Got a 70% open rate at the moment.
That's fantastic.
And I will get, when I put out an email, I will get, you know, 300-400 emails in that day, people replying.
Really?
Wow.
And I did a survey, and a staggering number said, yeah, would like to get an email from me every day. And it's like, well, that's not going
to
happen. But
nice to know, though.
I hate getting emails. You know, I hate it. It just annoys
me. Yeah, absolutely,
But it's reminding yourself that you are not your reader. You
know, exactly.
You go,
exactly.
Okay, I hate that, but there are hundreds of thousands of people in the world who love it, and it's going right. So you're the people that I'm trying to get to. Now, if I put out an email every day, I have no doubt that half my mailing list would unsubscribe immediately. But by God, that half that was left would be the most dedicated fan base you could hope for.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it is. It's finding your reader, and kind of you know, bringing your message to them, rather than going right, I'm gonna try and drag you in with advertising. It's going to them and going, you know, what's your life like? This is my life.
Yeah,
this is what's been going on.
I mean,
I find sending pictures, because living in the Highlands, in my email newsletter, I'll send a different picture of that I've taken when it's like, here's a mountain, you know, here's a stag, here's a river.
And they love that.
And they love it. Yeah, that's it. So, and they feel that bit of a connection to you as well. That's so.
Yeah.
So for me, this is what the cat did today. Or this is the cat sleeping.
I've done that.
Sunshine.
We got a cat as well. Not specifically for newsletter purposes, but it has cropped up in the newsletter a few times.
She's vital to our, you know, if she ever passes on, we're in trouble.
Well, there was one newsletter where I was talking about that the cat wasn't very well, and I got emails saying, oh, we really hope the cat's going to be okay. Yeah. Are you going to take it to the vet?
Hope we strung that out over a few weeks.
So in terms of where you are now and where you see things going in the future, in terms of, you're going to keep up the release rate, is that something you can sustain? Or
I mean, I probably could. I currently put out, last few years I put out about 6 books a year, so I'm a book every 2 months, and I'm kind of slowing down a little bit. I'm making a conscious decision to slow down a bit. I slow down to, you know, 4 books a year. I'm not going to do less than that at the moment. But we're also looking, we're kind of branching out through the publishing company. We've got a romance arm of the publishing company starting soon, And that's my wife and I kind of come up with the story together.
Ooh.
And
brilliant.
we got a ghostwriter to do like a first draft. And then we're taking that, and then we're going to kind of rip it to bits and do it in our voice. And do,
yeah.
But it was getting that. I didn't have the time to get that sort of bare bones story down, especially when it was an experiment, because it might be that nobody reads it. You know. So,
how much research do you do on the romance genre to get on top of that?
None. Just, I think. See, the thing is, and we all talk about every genre having its own tropes, and they do. That's true.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
But every story is essentially the same. Every story is, you know, within a certain kind of range of being exactly like every other story that's ever happened. So once you've got a decent understanding of story, it's easy enough to adapt that to different genres, I think. So, and my wife's read a lot more romance than I have, which is none.
But you said the same with crime, though.
Yeah, I know, that's it, exactly. Yeah, so just guess the plot of things.
Just go for it.
speaking of guessing, actually, what's always funny is I get emails quite regularly and people in the police who say, "Oh, you've nailed the procedure stuff. You've really got that." Because I've just guessed police procedure for Police Scotland for the last 3 years. But they go, "Oh, you nailed that." And similarly, there's a character in my books who's so over the top, ridiculously awful. Like, and he was a detective chief superintendent, and like he was written to be, you know, like that American sort of, "You've got 24 hours, I'm taking your badge." That horrible chief.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was like him, but like an exaggerated version, like to a point that this person could never exist. And the number of emails that I get, people saying, "I've worked with him. I've worked with that guy." And it's like, well, complain to HR. You can't work under that. I completely forgot what the question was there. I just got sidetracked on something.
No, I mean, just, you know, that release rate. So, it's one of those things where, I mean, we're looking at our list, and some people are coming to us with the first 3-4 ready.
Yep.
Knowing that that's where the market's gone.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the sense
that
you've got to keep the momentum.
Yeah.
And you just say, as you say, the best marketing is the next book.
Yeah.
But that's quite difficult for a lot of people to sort of get their heads around and then be that productive. So in terms of your methodology, how often do you bolt yourself to the keyboard?
Every day, really. So basically I use, working through traditional publishing for 10 years, never knowing if I could pay my bills next month, any work that came in, I would jump on it. So
sure.
A publisher would say, "We need this 20,000 word kids book written by Friday."
Yeah, you do.
And I would go, okay. And if that meant not sleeping for 2 days, fine, I would do that. Because that's what was needed. So I can apply that same mindset now. I go, well, this is a job, first and foremost. Mm-hmm. My job is to write books. I can't sit and wait for the muse to strike. Mm. So I use software called Pacemaker.
Right.
And I go, okay, so I, this book is going to be roughly 90,000 words. And I have until, you know, this date to do it. And Pacemaker goes, okay, you need to do this number of words every day. So if I don't hit that number of words, and I usually do most of my writing in the morning.
Yeah.
If I haven't hit that number of words, then I don't leave my desk until I have done. Or if I have to do something else, I have to come back and make sure I hit those words. And there will be days when like things go wrong. Mm. Like yesterday, I had a replacement bus service from the Highlands to get here. And I had planned to write 7,000 words on the train. That didn't happen, obviously.
No.
But when Pacemaker says you have to write 2,000 words a day, I will aim for 3,000 words a day. So I've always got kind of words in hand that, I mean, if something does go wrong, I'm okay. I don't have to panic too much because of my head of schedule. So right, as because of yesterday, I'm now pretty much on schedule because I had about 7,000 words spare. So now I need to go back and write 3,000. Well, I've actually written, before I got here, I wrote 3,000 words this morning before I came to the...
Oh, that is impressive.
Before 9 o'clock?
Before 9 o'clock,
that's
yeah.
very impressive.
My God. You're looking at me.
They're all
thinking,
rubbish. Like they're all
right. You're going to get me Pacemaker,
you
aren't you?
Pacemaker thing. Yeah.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. You know, because my work in progress has been sat there for about 4 years. So.
No, it's good. It does lovely graphs and all that.
Oh,
and it says,
right.
This is how far behind you are.
And that really appeals to me. So yeah, that's going to work for me.
You
right.
don't like graphs and stuff, do you?
No, I love anything. You know, when I'm wearing the old watch and checking how many steps I've taken and all that stuff. Yeah,
yeah
exactly. That
absolutely,
would work
yeah,
for me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Nice, colourful stuff. Colourful data.
Could you get your watch to say, you shouldn't be walking, you should be at your computer writing 2,000 words.
That'd be a good add-on. Get that for the...
Yeah,
an app that just shouts at you to sit down, type.
But when you're asleep, an alarm in the morning, get up, you need to write now.
Yeah. Well, that's why, because I, when I was doing, especially when I was doing the kids' books, it was like, sometimes I was working on 3 books at the same time, you know, for different publishers. And I was like, okay, I need to split my day up so these don't overlap.
Yeah.
So I don't suddenly write the wrong thing in the wrong book. So it would be, there was a spell I would get up at 6 o'clock every morning. There was a spell I'd actually get up at 5 o'clock every morning for a while. And I thought, I did that at 5 o'clock for about 3 months, because I thought, I'll adapt to it eventually. Didn't happen. I spent every morning I'd wake up crying. There was that alarm going off. I was like, no, it can't be now. But I put my alarm on the other side of the room.
And if you get up to get it
and see, you know, but see the time you've taken like 2 steps, that resistance has fallen away a little bit. And if you grab the phone, the alarm, walk through to the kitchen, the thought of going back to bed is then gone. And I'll go, right, okay, I'm now switched into work mode. So for me, it was about those initial get up, get moving. And once you're moving, it's much easier to go, right, it's time to write.
I'm in trouble here.
Yeah, well, I can see that look yeah, past there. Yeah.
Oh, it was frightening. Yeah, truly frightening. When you're here at the show, are you going to get about and talk to, or are you stuck with behind the plinth?
We can kind of wander at will. They're not holding us hostage.
You hear all sorts of things about Amazon.
You do hear terrible things, yeah. Funnily, that's one thing with traditional publishers, but we're always told Amazon hates authors. Amazon's the enemy. Amazon mistreats authors. And I've had a bloody lovely time since I moved to KDP. I can't fault it at all. I realise, I go, okay, well, they pay me every month.
Yes.
Whereas you pay me twice a year.
Yeah.
And you never tell me what I've... In fact, often you don't even do that. You know what I mean? You'll pay me in thirds and you'll do, well, we're holding that bit back and we're not giving you that until next time.
Yeah.
So but I know every month how much money's coming in, and it makes life much easier.
Yeah,
so,
it's completely transparent, isn't it?
So, yeah, so I can't fault, from an author's perspective, I can't fault.
You're not had any, I mean, because I was going to pick it up with the main man here. Mm-hmm. You know, occasionally there'll be a bump in the roads with us where they'll say you haven't got the contract for a certain thing, and then you cancel, and you're taken down for a bit. And have you not had any of those
issues? I had one issue, and it was the sixth book in my DCI Logan series. And it happened the night before the seventh book was due out. They'd emailed me earlier in the week and they said, this is, I can't remember what rules they said it was breaking, but the information they had, it was a completely different book. They sent it to the wrong person. It was like, no, this isn't my book. This is a book you flagged up as an issue. I've no idea what it is. And the title was there and everything. It wasn't, it's like, this isn't it.
Yeah.
You know, this is, and they went, okay, sorry about that. That's, yeah, obviously nothing's going to happen. Don't worry. And the night before the book was due, it got taken off Amazon. It got taken down. And so obviously they said, yeah, nothing will happen, don't worry, but hadn't told the people responsible for taking the book down not to do it. So the book vanished. But fortunately, I had been, you know, I know Darren from KDP anyway, so I was able to get onto him quite quickly, and he resolved it. But any other issues I've had, the help desk has been pretty good at resolving it. I haven't had anything that's been disastrous in any way.
No, we've had a few bumps, but, you know, it's got... better recently.
Yeah, I mean, I've had far more bumps with traditional publishing. One of my books through HarperCollins, they published 13,000 copies and they had my name wrong in the front, so they had to then pulp them.
It.
So you know,
that's a publisher's
nightmare. Every industry has issues. So these things happen. You know,
that was a bad day at the office for someone.
Yeah. No, what's worse is, they then there was also issues inside. So the top of page 17 was on page 18, and all the apostrophes had been replaced with double quotation marks. So it all gone terribly wrong. I was the one that spotted this. I got my author copies and went, there's some problems here. And they said, okay, don't worry, we're going to do an emergency reprint. It'll be done in 3 days. 3 days later, I was doing a launch event, 6 days, and 3 days later, no books. And they said, oh, there's been a bit of a hold-up. It's going to be 3 more days, but they'll be there for the launch event. When the books finally turned up, it was the third edition. And it turns out they'd reprinted the same file again 13,000 times and had to pop those as well. So by the time the first copy was on the shelves, they'd popped 26,000 copies.
I actually feel quite sick. Look at them.
Can you imagine?
And we're worried that we've got problems in the first 200 that we run. Yeah.
Wow. I'd imagine somebody got fired. I don't know.
What do you think?
I don't know, yeah. But
you
think, once you spot that problem, delete that file.
Yeah.
Don't go, we'll leave that around just temptingly, just in case. For a very similar
file
name.
I hope they learned a lesson from that.
Totally.
But they'd also put the whole PDF available on their website 6 months previously. It was supposed to be in a private section of the website to share with other international kind of branches, and they put it publicly available on the website. So it was free to read for 6 months. So absolute disaster they made of it.
I suddenly feel very much more much more competent.
Well, I found the bigger the publisher, the worse they were. I worked with big publishers, small publishers. And I never had any issues with small publishers. I worked with like Nosy Crow, who are down there.
Yes.
Stripes, yeah. And brilliant, very professional, never had any issues at all. The bigger the publisher, the less they seem to care about the individual books.
Yeah.
Mm. Especially HarperCollins, who just cared about David Walliams at that point.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
But the less they care about the individual books and the more these sort of errors slip through.
I think it also depends on who you work with, because I worked at Oxford University Press, and, mm-hmm. but my boss drummed into me, so even though you've checked it five times, check every single time. The yeah. author's name, ISBN, the title, the most important things. Even though you know that it's correct, still check it.
I wrote a book series for OUP, actually.
Oh, did you?
It was called Gazillas, and it was like about these little green slimy guys. It was a kind of ghostwritten thing. OUP came to me and said, do you want to do this? And I went, are you going to pay me money? Yeah. And they said, yep. And I said, then I'll do it. that is my quality control. I was like, will you pay me to do it? Yes, then I will, whatever is required.
Wow. I've got to ask, in terms of your appeal, is it mainly UK, or have you hit the States in any sort of significance?
I would say for the crime fiction, it's about 60% UK, 65% UK maybe.
Yeah.
And then probably about 20% US. Australia are really big into it. Canada,
yeah,
to an extent as well. I think Australia and Canada have a big Scottish connection.
They like
as well.
The Highlands, don't
yeah,
they?
The books that we've got yeah. that have yeah. those connections do yeah. well over there. Yeah,
but yeah, predominantly UK.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, some people chase that American market because it's
yeah,
so huge. But I
haven't bothered. The Space Team was bigger in America. The comedy sci-fi sure. stuff that did better in the US than it does in the UK. But there are more than enough readers in the UK to have a very successful career, a very rewarding career, without having to worry about, you know, other markets. Because I think there's a big expat community in the US and in Canada and all that who are interested in the Scottish thing. So that does bring some readers in. But I've never marketed it. I've never run an ad in America. I've never run an ad in, you know, an Amazon or Facebook ad over there. I just do UK.
Well, we also bring this to a thing. Have you got a random question?
I haven't, because we weren't going to do the random
No, that's
questions.
True. What we normally do is we have a Rebecca's random question.
I heard about this.
Yeah. But we haven't got one for you, so we'll have to get you back
well,
at some okay. point.
It's not really random, but it's just something that's come into my head just now.
Oh,
it's random then.
What is your favourite cocktail?
My favourite cocktail is, I don't even know if it classes a cocktail, it's a White Russian.
Yeah.
Because I watched The Big Lebowski when yeah. I was about, what was it, about 20, I think I saw it, and I just thought it was the best film I'd ever seen. And I became obsessed with White Russians at that point. Although I was on a tour with the Scottish Book Trust around Manchester, weirdly, and we went to the bar and the hotel we were staying at, and I were all getting drinks, and I asked for a White Russian, and the woman behind the bar looked really offended, and she was, it turns out, just a White Russian. she thought I was making some sort of, she couldn't understand what I was saying,
yeah.
Whether I was kind of, you know, making some derogatory remark about it or something, but no, it's a drink. I had to talk her through what the drink was. So yeah, White Russian is probably my cocktail of choice.
Good.
Although I had one recently.
Yeah.
Going off on a tangent, it was a bubblegum daiquiri.
Oh.
And it was like a, you know, slush puppy. Just
yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was like that.
You'd love that.
But bubblegum. Oh, it was amazing. It just tasted like liquid bubblegum. And it didn't, because as I get older, I find I'd rather things didn't taste of alcohol.
Yeah,
I kind of go.
But had the effect.
Yeah, I'd rather have that, but not the effect the next day. Because
yeah,
my hangovers at the moment kind of last like 4 days, 3 days of which I spent crying in a corner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'd like kind of something that's like just a bit, you know, fruity, or it doesn't taste too strongly of alcohol. That's what I kind of gravitate towards these days.
We had a bit of a night last night, and it certainly had an impact.
Well, the thing is, we didn't drink that much, but we were both lying in bed at midnight going, oh.
Yeah. You don't have to when you hit a certain age, do you?
No.
You know, my son, he's 19, and he's out. Perfect. He lives in Edinburgh now, and he's like hitting the town every night, and he's going, like, I messaged him at like 9 o'clock one night. He says, what are you up to tonight? He says, I don't know yet. Might go out. And it's like, what do you mean you don't know yet? It's 9 o'clock at night.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
that's right.
Like,
same
you should
mine,
be, you should
yeah,
be like
21.
Two-thirds of the way through the evening by now
yeah.
and thinking about heading home in a taxi.
Yeah, my son's exactly the same yeah. when he's at uni. He's like, you know.
The idea of starting a night at 10 o'clock or 11
no,
o'clock.
Absolutely.
What are you talking about?
Yeah.
I'm brushing my teeth then.
Yeah,
I don't know if you go out drinking with him, because my son will, you know, I'll be nursing a pint.
Yeah.
So I can probably manage a couple. I used to be able to do 10. But of course he can still do that, and,
yeah.
and it's all this sort of elbows out, yeah, you know, your spent force as a human, you know,
yeah,
that you can't
yeah,
you can't
yeah.
knock it back anymore.
My son won't even be seen with me in public.
Right, fair enough.
But yeah, my, because it's funny, because I'm doing all the kids' books, I'd go into all the schools locally, and when my son went to high school, he'd meet all the kids from the other school, and they were like, "Oh, we've met your dad. He's really cool." And my son very quickly set them straight on that front. So him and my daughter and my wife have been very good at keeping my feet firmly on the ground at all times.
Oh, it's fantastic! Well, thank you so much for sharing so much time with us.
You need to have a white really Russian now, I think.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm going to
do. We really learned a lot. So Barry, thank you so much for
having me.
The time.
Good to speak to you.
Cheers.
You.
Well, we got a kind of random question in there. Good one. Cocktails.
Yeah, inspired by the pink carpet.
Absolutely. Well done for thinking on your feet on that one.
I have to say, so we were talking in the first part of the podcast about us being introverts and also about your legs giving you some pain.
Oh, it's been awful.
Well, we're stood opposite a banner that is advertising a book, Yoga for Introverts. I think that's for you.
You're right, yeah. yeah, it might well be. There's also a book for a biography of Max Verstappen.
Oh, well, you keep looking at that, don't you? I think you want me to buy it for you.
Yeah, but you can't get it here. So
no, anyway. The books are here, but you can't buy them.
Exactly. Listen, tomorrow our podcast is going to feature a number of interviews. We have something lined up for you, which is a little bit off-beam in terms of not Pineapple Man.
Although,
but one of the smaller independent publishers here who specialise in books about climbing, which I've had contact with them in the past because they've asked me to do a couple of audiobooks in the past. I've never done it yet. But
never done it before?
No, never done that before. But we're also keen to speak to some of the other members of the IPG, the Independent Publishers Guild, who are some of them, like Boldwood Books are selling quadrillions of books, and Jacaranda are changing.
Yeah, they're doing brilliantly, aren't they?
They are. I mean, you know, they are changing the demographic of who writes, you know, popular fiction, because they are exclusively staffed by people from the Afro-Caribbean community. So we'll talk to them. Look forward to speaking to them. But we've also got one or two other things, special surprises for you. And of course, we will have Uncle Bob. We've got a dinner date to go to, head off to.
We do.
With one of my
oldest
friends.
I'm going
friends.
Out with two men. You again, I went out with two men last
you
night.
You did,
I'm
you
going
did.
Out with
yeah.
two men again.
Well, this time we won't be so much BBC reminiscing as you had to put up with yesterday as we went to Television Centre and see how they've revamped that. We're heading into the West End of London for dinner. And
that sounds so posh when you say
it does,
that.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Into the West.
It's a decent Lebanese, that's all I'm saying. So we'll look forward to speaking to you again tomorrow. And we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Hobcast Book Show. Don't forget to go to our website, www.hobeck.net, for details of all the books that we're trying to sell here at the Rights Festival, part of the London Book Fair. But from myself, Adrian Hobart.
And myself, Rebecca Collins.
Thank you so much for joining us. And we wish you, well, let's say a
creative day. Week,
creative few hours between podcasts. We'll speak to you again tomorrow. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Hobcast from Hoback Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hoback online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.